This is going to please exactly no one, but the economy says we gotta work harder, or maybe just smarter. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizal. Thursday, February 2nd. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are about to get the first on-the-record test of Donald Trump's economy. The January unemployment report comes out tomorrow morning. And yes, 19 and a half days of last month were on Obama's watch. But given the focus the new president has put on government economic numbers, that is how little faith he has in them, tomorrow's report is going to get special attention. We got worker productivity numbers today from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Remember, the simple formula is widgets produced per hour worked. And any way you slice those numbers, they are firmly on the mediocre side of good, slowing sharply in the fourth quarter. And for the year last year, worker productivity basically flat. Productivity is not one of the A-list statistics like unemployment or GDP growth, but rising productivity is the key to higher wages in this economy and eventually higher living standards. So from our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going with what is ailing this economy productivity-wise.
So I was sitting at a bar a while ago, and if you look at a typical bartender's labor process like an economist would, productivity has hardly changed in decades. Same soda spritzers, cocktail glasses, and mixers. Except it turns out my bartender, Lucas Plant, is also an e-commerce entrepreneur, selling bar tools online all over the world.
It's literally everything cocktail under one roof or on one website.
And that part of his labor has been enhanced by new technology, the internet, shipping at the click of a mouse. Multiply this through the whole economy, it would appear we're getting a lot more productive, says Josh Bivens at the Economic Policy Institute.
We get the sense that technology seems to be advancing.
And there's a debate among economists now. Maybe technology is boosting productivity more, we're just not capturing it in the government data. Patrick Newport at IHS Global Insight explains this line of thinking.
A lot of the innovations aren't being measured very well because they're new.
Newport says rapid improvements in medical care that can help doctors extend lives and prevent long hospitalizations haven't been well captured in productivity data. Or take all our new screens.
Well, it could be that we're just getting a lot more value out of some things, for example, computers. And it takes the government a while to figure out how to measure improvements in the quality of things like cell phones.
But Northwestern University economist Robert Gordon thinks it's more likely at this point the digital revolution just isn't aiding workers that much.
Much of the innovation is not doing anything to help productivity. Think of virtual reality, computer games.
He says they're enhancing our leisure time, but aren't doing much to boost efficiency in American workplaces. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Okay, now a story straight out of Econ 101, Supply and Demand. The commodity in question is doctors, especially in rural areas where there aren't enough of them to go around. One solution has long been to hire foreign-born physicians, which gets us to the president's travel ban and this report from Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein at the Health Desk at WHYY.
Imagine Central Texas, acres of cotton fields and pastures full of cattle. In between the agriculture and the livestock, says Dr. James Rohack, are towns of 500 or bigger ones with 3,000.
Many times it has a post office, it has a general store, and then the local physician.
Rohack works for Baylor Scott & White, the largest nonprofit health system in Texas, with more than 40 hospitals spread out over a region that's the size of Virginia. Rohack says these itty-bitty places often depend on foreign-born or at least internationally trained doctors.
For rural Texas, the international graduate has served as a backbone to assure that these communities don't go without.
Nationwide, more than one in five doctors are foreign medical graduates. About 8,000 physicians trained in the seven Muslim-majority countries banned by President Trump's executive order, according to new research from Dr. Anupam Jena, who works at the Massachusetts General Hospital.
This is a workforce that is desperately needed.
Jenna says not only are foreign-born doctors more likely to practice in places like those Texas towns, they're also more likely to practice in lower-paying fields like family medicine, pediatrics, and psychiatry. If future immigration bans threaten this labor supply, Georgetown economist Nicole Smith says rural hospitals will face a hard choice.
you either find more money to get more workers there, or you run the risk of having all of these slots unfilled.
If hospitals have to spend more money to fill those slots, Smith says it's the people in those communities who will have to pay more for their care. And the research shows those communities are the ones that tended to vote for President Trump. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
One more thing before we move on, the politics of Donald Trump's economy. The president's Business Advisory Council is set to meet tomorrow. A bunch of big-name CEOs offering their counsel to the White House. There is, though, going to be at least one empty seat at the table tomorrow. In an email to staff that Marketplace has confirmed, Uber CEO Travis Kalanick said he has left that panel. Wall Street today, a lot of ups and downs, signifying nothing. Flat. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The economic word of the day today is frictionless. If I could say it with a British accent, I would, because that is the key word in a draft law that British Prime Minister Theresa May is going to discuss tomorrow at a European Union summit meeting in Malta. She will say that the UK is going to approach Brexit talks with the EU with goodwill and that she wants a frictionless new trading relationship with the common market. May has President Trump's offer of a post-Brexit trade deal with the United States in her pocket, but whether that helps or hinders her negotiations is not yet entirely clear. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The ayes to the right, 498. The noes to the left, 114.
By a decisive majority, British lawmakers have just approved the Brexit bill. It's now passed its first big parliamentary hurdle, and Prime Minister May has a clear mandate to take Britain out of the EU. Brexit Secretary David Davis today spelled out the government's vision, an independent UK controlling its own borders, making its own laws, while forging
a new, positive and constructive partnership between Britain and the European Union that works in our mutual interest.
The government wants to keep unfettered access to the European market, and it believes that President Trump's support will help it in that aim. John Springford of the Centre for European Reform is not so sure.
The election of Donald Trump is something which makes the UK's Brexit hand weaker, not stronger.
He says Prime Minister May will get a frosty reception at tomorrow's summit in Malta. Many European leaders aren't happy about her hugging Mr. Trump. Guy Verhofstadt, the European Parliament's chief Brexit negotiator, identifies Trump as one of two figures on the global stage posing a threat to the EU.
Europe, for the moment, is squeezed between a populist president in America, who wants a disintegration of the Union, and an autocrat at the other side, Vladimir Putin, who wants also to divide Europe.
But what about security, asks Stephen Booth of the Open Europe think tank. He says the EU should cut a good deal with Britain if it helps keep the new president committed to NATO.
There has to be a relationship with the United States. I mean, the foundations of European security are not just the European Union, they are NATO.
But others argue the EU's number one concern now is keeping the bloc together, so the nation that decided to leave must not get too good a deal. Brexit must not be seen to be a success. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
All right, quick, what do Instagram, actress Mindy Kaling, and foam mattresses have in common? Give up? They are the subject of Katie Natopoulos' most recent column at BuzzFeed News. It's called Is This an Ad? Katie, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me about, first of all, Mindy Kaling's Instagram post.
So Mindy Kaling posted a picture of herself with a box, a cardboard box that contains a foldable Casper mattress. And she said, thanks to my friends at Casper, and also some extended joke about how she was excited for the new bed. And someone had pointed this out to me saying, is this an ad or not? I can't tell what's going on here.
Right. And you figured this was great fodder for the column. Is it an ad? Right?
Exactly.
There you go. So how'd you figure it out? What'd you do?
Well, first I reached out to a representative for Mindy Kaling, and they told me that she was in production and she wasn't able to answer questions right now or do interviews, which, fair enough.
Yeah,
then I reached out to Casper, and I asked them, hey, what's going on? Was this a freebie? Was she paid? And they responded that she was not paid to post about it, but she received 2 free mattresses.
Wow.
After I had reached out, they had went ahead. They realized that it was a little confusing the way that she had written her right. Instagram post. And so they asked her to change it. So now the Instagram post says, thanks to Casper for the gift.
Okay, so Mindy Kaling can obviously afford her own mattresses, even 2 of them, right? So what is the – why does this matter? What's the essence of this column and your reporting on this?
Well, so the FTC has these guidelines for how social media and blog posts about freebies and ads and things like that are supposed to go. And it's a little confusing because, you know, it's not as straightforward. When you see an ad on television, you immediately know, hey, it's the commercial break in my television show. This is an ad.
Yeah.
When you're streaming through Instagram and you see a celebrity who mostly posts pictures of themselves or, you know, whatever they're doing that day, and then all of a sudden there's a picture and they have a product and you're not really sure, do they just like that product? It's confusing.
Right, and it's you say this in the post about the Mindy Kaling ad. I mean, she posts on social about regular stuff, right? And so it's even a little more confusing.
Right. I mean, this is one of these things where the gray area is weird because it varies so much celebrity to celebrity. You know, Beyonce doesn't post about her favorite ice cream flavors. That's just not a thing Beyonce does. But Mindy Kaling does. She's someone who, like, loves to talk about, hey, I tried this thing and I love it. And that's something that normal people actually do. So that's not too weird. You know, I might say, hey, I love, you know, Schweppes ginger ale. It's my favorite soda. And that's I'm not getting paid by Schweppes for that. I just love ginger ale.
Is the disclosure when it happens usually as clear as thanks, Casper, for the gift? Or how do celebrities let us know that this is a freebie or a gift or they're being paid or whatever?
It's a little tricky. The FTC doesn't have an exact verbiage that it wants you to say. And so ideally it would be as crystal clear as possible. You would say hashtag sponsored, hashtag ad, which you do see in some places. And that's the sort of most clear version. The idea is to make it transparent for whoever is looking at
understand. For the casual watcher, right?
Right.
Katie Natopoulos, she writes for BuzzFeed News. Katie, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Coming up.
I particularly am in love with the commonness of our humanity.
Norman Lear has been on this earth for 94 years, so you would think he's got it figured out. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 6 points today, pretty much unchanged, 19,884. The NASDAQ off 4 points, about a 10%, 5636. The S&P 500 up a single point, 2280 there. As we mentioned, President Trump is scheduled to meet tomorrow with the heads of some big-name companies, so we'll look and how some of the companies on that business advisory panel did today. J.P. Morgan Chase gave back 0.4%. General Motors sputtered 1.1% lower. Checking some Australian companies, just, you know, because geopolitics. BlueScope Steel down 1.1%. Brambles Limited, which is a supply chain company based in Sydney, fell about 0.5%. Biotech company CSL Limited slipped about 1%. Bonds held steady. The yield on the 10-year T-note right at 2.47%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. This was not a good day for Ralph Lauren. The company announced CEO Stefan Larsson is out after less than 2 years on the job. The news came alongside a big miss on quarterly profits, and in response, shares did what you think shares would do on a day like today, off more than 12% at the close. The company has been working hard to change its ways. No easy trick for an old-school luxury brand that turns 50 years old this year, if you can believe that. But retail trends wait for no one, which is why Larsson, the now departing CEO, seemed like a good solution because he came up in the fast fashion world of Old Navy and H&M. His departure, though, means that Ralph Lauren is still trying to figure out how to survive. Marketplace's Annie Baxter had that one.
Ralph Lauren developed an iconic look. Upper crust folks sailing or playing polo, wearing shirts with little Ralph Lauren polo player logos. Here's Lauren talking about his philosophy.
What I believe in is his timelessness. The timelessness of an attitude.
But fewer shoppers are willing to pay for that timeless look lately. Stephen Barr is with the consulting firm PwC. He says luxury brands have been suffering since the Great Recession.
The consumer in the middle and at the lower end that has been aspirational to the premium channel and the luxury channel historically has really pulled back.
And now they frequently turn to fast fashion retailers like H&M and Zara. Milton Pedraza is a luxury retail consultant. He says Stefan Larsson, who came from companies like H&M, was trying to push Ralph Lauren more in the fast fashion direction.
The work that Larsson was going to do, which was very valuable in terms of streamlining and closing stores and improving the supply chain efficiency, was beginning to compromise the other elements that still need to be there.
Pedraza says you can't have all the efficiencies of fast fashion and maintain the high quality Ralph Lauren is known for. He says that kind of hybrid doesn't really exist. He thinks, if anything, Ralph Lauren should push towards the ultra high end, like its Black Label brand, to maintain its luxury status. But retail consultant Carol Speakerman says Ralph Lauren needs to reach a new generation of customers.
The Ralph Lauren brand itself cannot remain untouchable, and it can't be, you know, stuck in amber and stuck in time. It too has to evolve.
What that evolution looks like is causing some uncertainty. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Listeners of a certain age will remember the late 1970s, early 1980s sitcom One Day at a Time. Listeners not of a certain age are just going to have to take my word for it, because it is a classic of the genre, one of a string of shows created by the legendary Norman Lear, a single mom and her kids just trying to get by. Netflix is rebooting One Day at a Time for a 21st century audience dealing with a 21st century set of problems. Gloria Calderon-Kellett is one of the showrunners. Norman Lear is Norman Lear. Thank you both for coming down to the studio.
Thank you.
It's as easy as it seems.
That's the beauty of radio. Let me start with you, Norman Lear, and ask you why this show for the reboot. Of all the shows you've done, why One Day at a Time?
Because somebody came to me with the notion. I didn't happen to wake up with the idea. Brent Miller, young producer, one of the producers on our show, had been talking to somebody else. I don't know. I can't remember who that third person was.
Mm-hmm.
How about a Latino version of One Day at a Time?
Yeah.
The next thing that happened was to meet this young woman, Gloria Calderon-Kellett, and her partner, Mike Royce, partner on this project. And we all hit it off. And I fell in love with the idea, just sitting, talking, listening to her talk about her family.
So Gloria Calderon-Kellett, tell me about that. Because this is, I mean, it's a little autobiographical here, right?
Oh, yes.
Okay, it's a lot of autobiographical.
Oh, yes.
I wish you guys could see her eyes popping up.
Yes, well, you know, when somebody calls and says, would you like to sit down with Norman Lear?
Yeah.
You steady yourself on the nearest wall. And then you say, okay. So, you know, he's very disarming and very charming and so easy to talk to and so legitimately curious. And I just answered all of his questions, and he just was asking me about my family and how they came here. They came in 1962 from Cuba during a program called Operation Pedro Pan, which is something we talk about on the show.
Yeah.
And he asked me about my mother, and I told him all about her. She's a little boob popsicle firecracker. I said, just picture Rita Moreno. That's what my mom kind of was, you know.
Well, you're stealing the Rita Moreno question, because, I mean, she had, no disrespect to anybody else in this cast, but she is the whole smash on this show, man. She is unbelievable, right?
No, she's great. She's great. Justina Machado is her match.
And
they both know that's true. The woman who plays the lead. That's totally true.
Oh, my God.
How different is it for you? And we should say you came from many other places, Gloria, but How I Met Your Mother. So you've done traditional network, and Norman, you've obviously done a bunch. How different is it not to have to do this thing in three acts with 22 minutes of content and commercial breaks as opposed to doing it for half an hour?
It's glorious.
It's great.
And the other beauty is that with this extra time, because I was on Rules of Engagement was the last multi I was on, and those episodes were about 20 minutes.
Multi-camera,
multi-camera,
right?
Yes. Those were about 20 minutes, 21 minutes maybe.
Yeah.
That's 8 minutes of content is quite significant in having those silent moments and those jokes.
And you take a beat and whatever, right?
I remember back to 27 minutes was the, or 26 point something. And then they just started to take more time out.
For commercial.
Then of the reruns, they wanted to take time out. So we had to go back and edit our own shows, and that was agony. Agony, taking time out of content that you cared about.
You, in your earlier days, were known for, and still are known for this, for incisive social commentary on events of the day. And you're taking this on in this show as well, right? With illegal immigration and with, you know, women in the military. I mean, all of that stuff. How much are we going to see in season two of this show of what's going on in the American body politic today?
Well, that's a great question, because we've got a Gloria Calderon-Collette here and a Mike Royce, who are family people, as I said, to the extent that her family comes to see the show. And Mike Royce, a dad and, you know, a family man. And we're going to be dealing with the problems that face all Americans. We start as Americans. So we're going to deal with the problems that face all Americans. And then we're a Latino family.
Mm-hmm.
And I particularly am in love with the commonness of our humanity. You know, I've never worked with a Latina family, but a Jewish family isn't all that different. Mm-hmm. They're human beings. They love and react and are upset the same way. The same way in a real human way, very different in the way they perform. So I'm learning a great deal about this woman and her family.
Intending absolutely no disrespect, I have the sensation right now that you're not answering the question the way you want to answer the question, right? The question was, let's think about what's going on in this country right now.
Yeah.
And you're Norman Lear, and you're the guy who put Maude on the air and All in the Family on the air and things that spoke sharply and incisively about what was going on in this country.
Right. And we're going to be talking about, do we really want a five-year-old with a biscuit in his pocket?
And a phone.
And a phone.
We'll turn the phone off.
But I've got a very...
He always answers the phone. Right. He's answered...
Is he really going to answer the phone?
Hello?
Yeah.
There
yeah.
we go.
He always does. This is a really
true
thing.
Hello?
Wow.
Even in pitch meetings.
Oh, you're going to love this.
We would like to inform you that your membership rewards points have been...
Oh, no, you're kidding. My membership rewards...
Oh, no. Oh, this really is...
This is so important.
This is a real thing. That actually happened.
Yeah.
No, here's the thing. I have six... children.
Yeah.
I've told them forever, I will never, I'll always be available to you. They call rarely, but when they call, it's for something important. So I keep the phone on. I'm sorry.
Amen to that. No, that's fair. That's totally fair. And it's a lesson I could take as a dad.
to get to your question now, I think the one difference between Netflix and what Norman was able to do is the speed with which he was able to talk about things that were happening in the news.
Right.
We are
on a weekly production
on
cycle.
On a weekly
back
production
then.
Cycle. We have to, we finished shooting our show in August.
Wow.
So we knew we couldn't talk. We would have loved to talk about the election. We would have loved to talk about the what was happening in this country at that time. We couldn't do it because we didn't know who was going to be president. We didn't know what things were going to be when we knew we would be airing in January.
Mm-hmm.
So are there things we're going to want to talk about with this election? And yes, how we have to be we have to be smart in the way that we do that because we don't know what's going to be happening 6 months from that point. Does that mean flashbacks to the election and to marches and things like that? Perhaps. But we're not exactly, we would like to do it.
Right.
Yes.
We That's would the way we're going to have to do it.
Right.
We were talking 10 minutes before we sat down with you about how to deal with it. You know, we've got a 6-year-old in the White House with a biscuit in his pocket. And we got to talk about that.
Norman Lear, Gloria Calderon Kelly. It's One Day at a Time on Netflix. Thank you both so much.
Thank
You're
you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Final note on the way out today from the Marketplace desk of Go Big or Go Home. Snap filed for its initial public offering today. Snap, of course, being the corporate parent of Snapchat and those, one man's opinion here, funny-looking Snapchat spectacles. Two things to note about this. The company said in its filing that it has never made a dime in profits, not even a penny. Also, this is kind of a gutsy move because Uber and Airbnb and Pinterest, to name just a couple other big-name tech firms, are still comfortably not publicly traded. All right, we got to go. By the end of the day on Wall Street today, things were really close to where they started, basically unchanged all the way around. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.